Good evening. It is historic. In a 5-3 ruling, the Supreme Court struck down a Texas law designed to shut down most of the state's abortion clinics with medically unnecessary restrictions.
One, we are absolutely ecstatic.
Rupali Sharma is on the Texas team of the Center for Reproductive Rights.
We think that today the court has affirmed that all women, regardless of their background, deserve compassion, respect, and dignity in making their healthcare decisions. The court was extremely clear that it won't stand for sham laws anymore. It has given us a standard that will allow us to challenge the sham laws that have been sprouting up throughout the country.
The court ruled that the Texas law was a veiled attempt to make it harder for women to get abortions. Two requirements were challenged in the Texas case, an admitting privileges requirements where doctors needed to have privileges at a local hospital, and the other an ASC, ambulatory surgical center requirement to force abortion facilities to comply with the criteria of admitting hospitals or of ambulatory surgical centers.
Even though abortion is 14 times safer than childbirth, and you can give birth to a child in your home without a doctor present.
Sansara Taylor is with Stop Patriarchy and the Revolutionary Communist Party. She has led numerous protests to stop attacks on women's health care.
The idea that you have to get an abortion in a mini emergency room, these are incredible burdens on the providers, and they forced so many clinics in Texas to close, which did create a situation where hundreds of miles in Texas had no abortion access, no abortion facilities, and women were forced to travel. They were forced to stay overnight and undergo unnecessary waiting periods. And huge numbers of women could not get the resources together to do that. The rates of self-inducing abortions in Texas skyrocketed in the last few years. And so it's very important that this was thrown out, but a lot of those clinics have already closed. This is part of what's so outrageous. Many of those clinics already closed. They sold their properties. Doctors and staff were laid off. So, you know, again, this is a major decision. It's a very important decision, but it's not an end to the war on women. And it is part of, I was down here with the revolutionary supporters of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we're fighting and we're upholding this, but we're also fighting and preparing people to overthrow this system at the soonest possible time, because patriarchy and the enslavement of women is woven into this country, into the fabric and its foundation. And the fact that this case could even get as far as it did, the fact that the standard that it was thrown out by, which was the Casey decision, undue burden itself allows way too much restriction. So again, it's a very positive, very important development today, but this country is incredibly polarized, and this is not the end of the war on women.
Rupali Sharma with the Center for Reproductive Rights says Texas argued laws were meant to promote women's health.
What the court made clear was that they didn't promote health in the least. In fact, they harmed it by introducing all these burdens to abortion access. You know, women having to travel hundreds of miles, women facing long waits at abortion clinics and having to have abortions later in their pregnancy, having to do degrading things like, you know, having to sell their belongings and sleep in their cars and all of those things. Of course, you know, they actually detract from women's health. So they didn't serve the stated purpose of the law and actually introduced really, really harsh burdens. And then that combined again with the severe burden on abortion access, the law could not withstand constitutional scrutiny. And that's why the court struck down both laws, not only the admitting privileges law, but also the ASC requirement.
Justice Breyer wrote that the surgical center requirement, like the admitting privileges requirement, provides few, if any, health benefits for women, that it poses a substantial obstacle to women seeking abortions and constitutes an undue burden on their constitutional right to do so. Justices Anthony Kennedy, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan joined Breyer. Ginsburg wrote a short opinion. She noted that laws like Texas's do little or nothing for health. Rather, they strew impediments to abortion and can survive judicial inspection under the court's earlier abortion rights decisions. She pointed specifically to Roe v. Wade in 1973 and Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Alito and Thomas dissented. Even though Sansara Taylor with Stop patriarchy is so pleased that the Texas law has been struck down. She's outraged it was ever in effect for so long.
But it was able to close over 20 clinics, and over the last 3 years has really put women through hell throughout Texas and in many other places. So this is an important decision. It's a really important victory today, but it's also not an end to the war on women, and we saw that out there as well. So I want to, as important as it is that this happened, I want to call on everybody to join with me and others in standing up and continuing to fight to stop what is an ongoing war against women.
The Supreme Court ruling will now affect similar laws in other states. According to the Center for Reproductive Rights, it sends a very strong message to those who would seek to limit women's access to abortion.
What it says is that, you know, if you're going to pass an abortion restriction and you don't have a reason, you can't provide evidence that there's actually a valid reason. And again, in this case, Texas argued that it was medical. It will be struck down if it harms women. The court was unequivocal about that today.
Sharma says the court really understood that the law was hurting the most vulnerable women today. But she says it's still important to remain vigilant in the face of what's going on.
This is only the first step, right? There are hundreds of medically unnecessary laws throughout the country. This is the first step in dismantling them, because now we have a clarification of the standard, right? We know what legislatures are permitted to do and what they're not permitted to do. And they're not permitted to sneak around the Constitution and inject their personal beliefs into women's decision making. But armed with that, now we can go into these other states and continue challenging these laws. So it's certainly a first step. But it's an unequivocal victory, and we couldn't be happier.
Rupali Sharma is on the Texas legal team with the Center for Reproductive Rights. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. New York City's annual Gay Pride Parade began on Sunday with a moment of silence for the victims of the massacre at Pulse, the Orlando gay nightclub, earlier this month. Pulse owner Barbara Poma, on top of a Stonewall Inn float, led the parade. Some marchers wore T-shirts which said gays against guns. There was a float from the Callan Lord Community Health Center. An NYPD marching band carried Happy Pride Day signs. Politicians were out in number. Governor Cuomo with Hillary Clinton. Marchers with a rainbow banner wore purple, red, and orange T-shirts which said Love Trumps Hate. Nearby New York City Council members from throughout the city, Melissa Mark Vivodito, Danny Drum, Jimmy Van Bramer, Jimmy Vaca, Margaret Chin, Ben Kalos, Rory Lantzman, Richie Torres, Antonio Reynoso, and others were all on the march. Amidst a sea of rainbow flags and signs with the hashtag #WeAreOrlando, a contingent wearing white veils on the march held up portraits of people murdered in Orlando, chanting Love Trumps Hate. While crowds of onlookers stood a dozen deep along Fifth Avenue, the LGBTQ community occupied the street in a sit-down. And they chanted, "How many more have to die?" On the papal plane, Francis told a group of journalists on Sunday that the Catholic Church and Christians owe gays an apology for the way the church treated them in the past. When asked if he agreed with recent comments by a top advisor that the church should apologize to gays, Francis said homosexuals should not be discriminated against, and he added, "I think the church must not only apologize to a gay person it offended, but we must apologize to the poor, to women who have been exploited, to children forced into labor, apologize for having blessed so many weapons." And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. In the wake of Brexit, Britain's vote to exit the European Union, people have been reporting incidents of racism in London against Polish arrivals. Francis, on that plane ride, called for the European Union to come up with creative new ways to stay together. Bridges are better than walls. Speaking in the British House of Commons on Monday, British Prime Minister and Conservative Party leader David Cameron says we have a fundamental responsibility to bring our country together.
In the past few days, we've seen despicable graffiti daubed on a Polish community centre. We've seen verbal abuse hurled against individuals because they're members of ethnic minorities. Let's remember these people have come here and made a wonderful contribution to our country. We will not stand for hate crime or these kinds of attacks. They must be stamped out. Mr. Speaker, we can reassure European citizens living here and Brits living in European countries that there'll be no immediate changes in their circumstances. Neither will there be any initial change in the way our people can travel, in the way our goods can move, or the way our services can be sold. The deal we negotiated at the European Council in February will now be discarded, and a new negotiation to leave the EU will begin under a new Prime Minister. Turning to our economy, it's clear that markets are volatile. There are some companies considering their investments, and we know this is going to be far from plain sailing. However, we should take confidence from the fact that Britain is ready to confront what the future holds for us from a position of strength.
The British Prime Minister says steps were taken to immediately stabilise the economy.
The markets may not have been expecting the referendum result, but as the Chancellor set out this morning, the Treasury, the Bank of England and our other financial authorities have spent the last few months putting in place robust contingency plans. As the Governor of the Bank of England said on Friday, the bank's stress tests have shown that UK institutions have enough capital and liquidity reserves to withstand a scenario more severe than the country currently faces. And the bank can make available £250 billion of additional funds if it needs to support banks and markets.
British Prime Minister David Cameron on Monday. Britain's Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn is facing a revolt from some of his party's legislators, with accusations from his own party that he led a weak campaign in Britain's EU referendum. Corbyn is the leader in Britain who stands for ending austerity, protecting workers' rights, blocking welfare cuts, scrapping tuition fees, creating a national education service, and withdrawing from NATO and scrapping Trident nuclear weapons. He was elected 9 months ago as leader of the Labour Party. Now he is facing a motion of no confidence, but seems to still have Labour Union backing.
The Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Firstly, I would like to thank the British people for turning out to vote in the referendum in such high numbers. The vote was a reflection of the significance of the issue. But it was a close vote on the back of a campaign that was, too often, divisive and negative. These benches put forward a positive case to remain part of the European Union and convinced more than two-thirds of our own supporters. But the majority of people have voted to leave, and we have listened to and accepted what they've said. Many people feel disenfranchised and powerless, especially in parts of the country that have been left behind for far too long. Communities, Mr. Speaker, that have been let down, not by the European Union, but by Tory governments. Those communities don't trust politicians to deliver because for too long they haven't. So, instead of more extreme cuts to local services, which have hit the areas the hardest, this government needs to invest in those communities. Many of those areas are deeply concerned about the security of pledged EU funding. Can the Prime Minister give us any guarantees on those issues, as that money is desperately needed? Secondly, it's the issue of trust. And the tenor in the referendum campaign was disheartening. Yeah. Half-truths and untruths were told, many of which key Leave figures spent the weekend distancing themselves from, not least the claim that the vote to leave the Leave would hand the NHS an extra £350 million per week. It is quite shameful that politicians made claims they knew to be false and promises they knew could not be delivered. Thirdly, real concern exists about immigration, but too much of the discussion in the referendum campaign was intemperate and divisive. And in the days following the referendum result, It appears we have seen a rise in racist incidents, such as the attack on the Polish centre in Hammersmith, which the Prime Minister quite rightly referred to, and sadly, many other such incidents all over this country. I hope the Prime Minister and Home Secretary will take all action they can to halt these attacks, halt this disgraceful racist behaviour on the streets of this country. As political leaders, we have a duty to calm our language and our tone, especially after the shocking events of 10 days ago. Our country is divided, and the country will thank neither the benches in front of me nor those behind for indulging in internal factioning manoeuvring at this time. Mr Speaker, we have serious matters to discuss in this House and in the country. And
I want to accommodate as many as possible of those colleagues who wish to question the Prime Minister. Matters are just slowed up if people make a lot of noise. I've got plenty of time. I don't know whether other people have. Jeremy Corbyn.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. It does appear that neither wing of the Tory government has an exit plan, which is why we're insisting that the Labour Party be fully engaged in the negotiations that lie ahead. We need the freedom to shape our economy for the future and protect social and employment rights while building new policies on trade, on migration, environmental protection and on investment. I fully understand the Prime Minister is standing down in 3 months' time, but we cannot be in a state of paralysis until then. The Prime Minister is meeting the European Council tomorrow. I hope he's going to say that negotiations will begin so we know what's going on, rather than being delayed until October. We as a House have a duty to act in the national interest and ensure we get the best agreements for our constituents. Will the Prime Minister today confirm that in the light of the economic turmoil, the Chancellor would announce at least a suspension, preferably the termination, of his now even more counterproductive fiscal rule? What the economy needs now is a clear plan for investment, particularly in those communities that have been so damaged by this government and sent such a very strong message to all of us last week. Will he specifically rule out tax rises or further cuts to public services that were threatened in the pre-referendum? I welcome his assurances on the uncertainty felt by many EU nationals currently working in our economy, including the 52,000 who work so well and help our National Health Service to provide the service we all need. It is welcome that the Prime Minister is consulting with the leaders of devolved administrations, and I hope with the Mayor of London too, a city for which the implications are huge. We must act in the public interest and support measures to reduce volatility. I welcome market protections, but what about protections for people's jobs, their wages and their pensions?
British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon suggested the Scottish Parliament could be able to keep Britain from leaving the EU. On Sunday, she told the BBC that she would ask the Scottish Parliament not to give legislative consent to removing Britain from the EU. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is visiting Brussels and London today as the world is grappling with implications of Britain's historic vote to leave the European Union.
The vote did not come out the way President Obama and I and others hoped that it would, but that's democracy, and we respect the rights of the voters and we respect the process. So it is now incumbent on leaders to implement the will of the people and to do so in a way that is responsible, sensitive, thoughtful, and I hope strategic. I think it's important to note that ever since World War II, we have been working, all of us together, on the development of a structure to be able to make our country stronger and to be able to deliver a good life benefits to our people. The interests and the values which have united us for such a long period of time did not change on the day of that vote. Now, it is critical as we go forward in these next days to understand the importance of a strong EU. The United States cares about a strong EU.
And finally, the Democratic Platform Drafting Committee wrapped up its work this weekend with gains and losses to progressive communities. While the draft says Americans should earn at least $15 an hour, it falls short of making this the minimum wage or indexing the $15 to inflation, which is what Bernie Sanders wanted. In the draft, there is not a call for a Medicare for all single-payer health care system or a carbon tax to address climate change. And there is no ban on fracking. In addition, Sanders, who opposes the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was unable to get language into the document opposing the trade deal, even though Hillary Clinton says she opposes the deal. Putting it into the document would have put the platform at odds with President Obama. Another area of contention dividing Democrats is the Israel-Palestinian conflict. Cornel West on the platform committee is critical of APAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, a lobbying group which advocates pro-Israeli policies, and he supports the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. He said one thing both sides can agree on is that a precious Palestinian baby has exactly the same value as a precious Jewish baby in Tel Aviv.
A commitment to security for precious Jewish brothers and sisters in Israel can never be predicated on an occupation of precious Palestinians. If we're concerned about security, it seems to me, we're going to have to talk seriously about occupation. Now, I don't know whether you would allow the use of that word. You know, New York Times said we got to put it in inverted commas. You know what I mean? No, occupation is real. It's concrete. But at the same time, how do we acknowledge Jewish people 2,000 years hated, haunted, vicious contempt, pogroms, Shoah, and so forth. Preoccupation with security, understandable. Palestinians, made in the image of God like anybody else, wrestling with occupation for 50-some years, demeaned, devalued, dominated, exploited. For too long, the Democratic Party has been beholden to AIPAC that didn't take seriously the humanity of Palestinian brothers and sisters. We're at a turning point now. And of course, it's going to be a slow one in the Democratic Party, but some of us will be working outside the Democratic Party to make it quicker. And that's why I support the BDS, not because I think it's anti-Semitic. We've got to fight anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish hatred. It goes hand in hand with every Christian civilization, and many Islamic civilization is wrong, it's unjust, but that cannot be the excuse of in any way downplaying the unbelievable misery that we see in Gaza, in West Bank, and other places.
West and other Bernie Sanders supporters wanted the word occupation in the platform and equal protection for Palestinians.
On the irony that strikes me about our right obsession with Trump, right-wing, xenophobic, narcissistic, neo-fascist, and Trump-like figures in Israeli life, Lieberman, Ariel, why is it that we could focus so clearly on the xenophobes here and rightly call them into question, and at times seem to be so reluctant to call into question xenophobes in other places, not just Israel, but other places as well when it comes to U.S. foreign policy? That just strikes me as something that we as a people have to come to terms with. I can put it another way, that if there were a Palestinian occupation of precious Jewish brothers and sisters, would we respond in the same way as opposed to an Israeli occupation of Palestinian brothers and sisters? And myself, believing very deeply in what Jane Austen calls constancy, moral consistency, that I want to have moral outrage in both of those cases.
As it stands now, the draft reflects Clinton's views and advocates working towards a two-state solution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which guarantees Israel security with recognized borders, and it provides the Palestinians with independence, sovereignty, and dignity. The draft now goes to the full platform committee for final approval at a meeting in Orlando, Florida on July 8th and 9th, then a vote at the convention in Philadelphia in late July. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said he wanted the platform to reflect his goals. James Zogby, one of Sanders' supporters on the committee, said, "We lost some, but we won some. We got some great stuff in the platform that has never been in there before." Sanders, in a statement, says he was disappointed and dismayed that the group voted down the measure opposing the TPP, but he was pleased with proposals on Glass-Steagall and the death penalty, and he vowed to fight on. He said, "Our job is to pass the most progressive platform in the history of the Democratic Party." On Friday, Bernie Sanders said he would vote for Hillary Clinton, the presumptive nominee in the fall election, but so far he stopped short of fully endorsing her or encouraging his millions of voters to back her candidacy. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.